This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
They furloughed about 25 to 30% of workers during the pandemic, and they didn't bring them back. And they're using that as a business model to have less crew members running the trains.
Great stress and horrific labor conditions for railroad workers. Is a railway strike still possible?
And the girls and the women were basically, you know, put in the budget, so to speak, and counted as inventory, along with other military supplies, as toilet paper or pencils or what have you. And they were considered disposable goods. One dies, then you'll get another one.
Supporters of the Comfort Women's cause are voicing outrage over the continued denial of Imperial Japan's history of sexual slavery in the wake of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's upcoming $10 million funeral.
The U.S. is a party to this war. This is a proxy war. What does it mean when you're a proxy war? What it means is you're fighting your adversary, but you're using other people to fight and die.
And growing concern about the expanding war in Ukraine. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Nearly 125,000 railway workers came close to going on strike last Friday. They have dangerous and deadly working conditions imposed by railroad owners, including Warren Buffett, who owns BNSF Railway. The COVID pandemic has put further stress on railroad workers. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke to Gabe Christensen, Nevada railroad conductor and co-chair of RWU, Railroad Workers United.
It's been tough. It's precision scheduled railroading, and it's a business model that most Class 1 railroads are using now. They use the pandemic as an excuse. They furloughed about 25 to 30% of workers during the pandemic, and they didn't bring them back. And they're using that as a business model to have less crew members running the trains. And traditionally, we were able to take sick days and things like that, but to stop us because they had a reduced labor force, they put in these attendance policies that make it almost impossible to get time off. Where I work, you get 8 points when you lay off sick. And if you hit 28 points, then you could lose your job. So 4 days in a 90-day period, and you could be terminated possibly for taking sick time off. All with the COVID-19 going on and, you know, flu and everything like that.
So you're saying if you're actually sick, you get penalized for being sick by these companies?
Yeah, if I'm sick, there's potential that I could be terminated for taking 4 days off because it would put me over that 28-point threshold.
Should it be illegal, I mean, to do something like that? I mean, being punished if you're sick?
It's not fair. I mean, everyone gets sick. You know, everyone has stuff that comes up in their lives. And a lot of us don't know when we're going to work. There's no set schedule. You're on call 24 hours a day. Before we had federally mandated time off, now if you work 6 days off, by federal requirements, you have to have a 48-hour period off. But before that, it was just nonstop. You could work indefinitely. But the thing that made a difference was we were able to take time off then. And they've gotten rid of that in the last 5 years. So it makes it really hard. You can't anticipate when you're going to work, when you're going to be home. It's nights, weekends, holidays, in the snow, the heat, the rain. The fires now are a big thing that we've been having to deal with on the West Coast here. They run fire trains, so we're actually out spraying water on the tracks and fighting the fires along the tracks and everything. And, I mean, stuff comes up, and to be penalized for taking time off, I mean, it's a travesty. A big thing that our unions are fighting for is not even compensated time off. They're wanting even just uncompensated time off, just to where we won't be terminated or have discipline levied against us for taking sick days. With COVID and everything, or even with the flu, or sick children too, you know, there's a lot of single parents that work out here. if their child's sick, they got to take time off and take care of their kid. They can't just leave them at home. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things. And they say we get time off. Right now, I get four weeks of vacation, and I get 8 personal leave days that are compensated. But you have to prearrange these days is the way that works. So depending on your seniority is where your weeks of vacation land in the year. If you have less seniority, you only have maybe 3 months, just for example, to use that. So you have from January to March to use that time off. If you can't prearrange the time, then whenever your date to start your vacation is when you have to take it. And the way they have it set up for us to prearrange time off is there's a calendar, and I'm pretty sure it goes out 90 days, and you click on the day that you need to prearrange off. Well, if it's within a day or two of a holiday, they black that out so you can't even prearrange that day. Or they may just let one person in a terminal where there's, you know, 60 or more employees trying to get a day off, they may only allow one person to prearrange that day. So with being on call and having to take trains out of town and not knowing when you're going to get back, a lot of times you may have to take 2 to 3 days off to make a doctor's appointment, because we all know doctors only work Monday through Friday. So if you're waiting to go to work on Wednesday and you think you're going to go at like 8 in the morning, and you prearrange the day for Friday because you figure, oh, there should be a way for me to make it back in time. Well, the trains lay down because one derails or breaks down or there's a weather issue or something like that. The prearranged day you made for Friday to try to make your doctor's appointment, now you're going to work Thursday night and you're never going to make it back in time to make that doctor's appointment. So that's another reason why we need to be able to take uncompensated time off, because it's like playing horseshoes, you know. You're just trying to get close, but you can't always do it right, you know what I mean? With working with less people and having to work more and not have time, be able to take time off to get rest, you're talking to people who are sometimes they're expecting to go to work in the morning, so they slept that the night before, and now maybe the train's late, but fall back, so you're up all day. And then all of a sudden, right when you lay down to take a nap, 10 o'clock at night, the phone rings. So by the time you get off work, you may have been up 20, 30 hours because you can't anticipate your schedule to get adequate rest to take your train sometimes. You have people out there working fatigued, and they're putting more and more stress on people to perform. And plus, you're working with trains that are longer than we've ever seen in my career. I've been out here 18 years now, and for a long time when I hired out, if you had a 6,000-foot train, which is just a little over a mile, it was a decent-sized train. Now we're running trains that are 3 miles long, and it's not just conductors and engineers that have the manpower issues. It's carmen that maintain the cars and everything. It's track maintenance. It's everything, so there's a lot of variables in our industry that create situations that could happen. In regards to the two-man crew, I can't even tell you how many close calls we've had with hitting pedestrians where one person may not see it and the other person may see the person, and, you know, you can blow the horn to get them out of the way and everything like that. One that really sticks out in my mind is there was an older lady standing in the middle of the railroad tracks. There was a little bit of snow on the ground, and she had a jacket that was black and white speckled. And with the ballast, the rock alongside the tracks in the snow, she blended right in. There was 3 of us on the train because I was on a local. The engineer and I was the brakeman. We didn't see her, and at the last minute, my conductor saw her and started blowing the horn. And luckily, she jumped out of the way. But, I mean, if we wouldn't have that other set of eyes, who knows what would have happened, you know?
That was Gabe Christensen speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Railroad workers still have not received the language of their labor contract that was agreed to at the White House with Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, their union leaders, and the railroad companies. They will be voting on the contract, and the strike is still possible if they reject it. House Leader Nancy Pelosi, however, has promised that she and the Democrats will pass legislation to prohibit a strike. Their right to strike is already restricted by the 1926 Railway Labor Act, which, according to Christensen and other workers, has been used to destroy their working conditions and led to injuries and death. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. In the wake of the assassination of former Japanese Prime Minister and right-wing nationalist Shinzo Abe in early July, the relationship between him, his Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, and the Korea-based Unification Church, or Moonies, has come under daily scrutiny and caused a mounting political scandal for the ruling LDP. Abe had a long career encouraging Japanese military expansion and denying the Imperial Army policies, including sexual slavery during World War II. He also worked to eliminate Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution that prevents offensive war. He and the LDP continue to support U.S. bases in Okinawa and more nuclear power plants in Japan despite the continuing Fukushima nuclear disaster. The Comfort Women and their supporters have also voiced outrage that Abe is scheduled to receive a state funeral on September 27th, which will also be attended by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Kamala Harris. The majority of Japanese people are also opposed to the $10 million government-funded state funeral. Thomas O'Rourke, a Pacifica reporter in D.C., recently spoke to retired California Superior Court Judge Julie Tang and Miho Kim of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition about all these issues.
It was Iris Chang who wrote a book called Rape of Nanjing that inspired me to learn more about what Japan did or the Japan military did. And of all the atrocities that were committed, the one that was associated with women was the Comfort Women issue. It's a euphemistic term for sexual enslavement of women in 14 countries throughout Asia. What these women went through was extreme and cruelty in rape, torture, and murder. And it is probably the worst atrocity that were ever committed against women in modern history. And unfortunately, the Japanese government, in particular, under the late Shinzo Abe, has tried to suppress that history and committed a whole generation of Japanese people in Japan into forgetting about what Japan did during World War II. Those of us who are grassroots movement folks and peacekeepers wanted to share this history with the American public and the West, because these information are important and they're serious and have implications about how we go forward in handling issues of genocide on women, femicide, and human rights and crimes against humanity. So we thought that it would be important for us to join up with the movements that are globally developing, and that is to remember the history, in particular the history of the Comfort Women Institution. In 2017, a group of us, Miho Kim, myself, Jessica Lillian Singh, Judith Merkinson, Michael Wong, and Grace Shimizu, representing different organizations, and we co-released about 20 organizations, made primarily women and peace organizations, to develop a plan to put on a memorial called the Comfort Women Memorial in San Francisco. Previously, Comfort Women Memorials are splattered all over America in about 10 cities, but this is the first time that a big city like San Francisco is having its memorial. And of course, we received nothing but obstruction and interference from the Abe administration. I'm going to defer to Miho now for her to explain her perspective in this Comfort Women movement.
First off, let's just establish that abundance of documentation does exist in spite of what is said to be like more than 70% of official documents by the Japanese military having been burned upon certainty that there is going to be defeat on their part in World War II to avoid further investigation. And so on the global level, today there is pretty much an established consensus that this is a historical fact, that not only did the Comfort Women system exist, but that it was specifically established, administered, managed, and overseen by the Japanese military, Imperial Army, and that there was coercion of women and girls, and at some times, you know, boys as well, entailed in procurement, quote unquote, of the women necessary to run the system. And the system spanned across 13, 14 nations and territories that Japan invaded and slash or occupied. One thing that I would mention as an example just comes to mind is a former Prime Minister of Japan, Nakasone, wrote a memoir of his life coming up as a young army official during World War II and rising up in the ranks to eventually become Prime Minister of Japan. And he reflects on one of his proud moments in serving in the army is when he came up with a new accounting system for the military to basically be able to manage the Comfort Women system. And the girls and the women were basically, you know, put in the budget, so to speak, and counted as inventory along with other military supplies as toilet paper or pencils or what have you. And, they were considered disposable goods. One dies, then you'll get another one. That's sort of how that worked. This is a system of total control over other human beings in a case of racialized colonial violence that took full advantage of the pre-existing patriarchal system in places that the Japanese Empire entered into. And so the marriage of all these different systems of oppression, that's what made this massive system of sexual slavery possible and unchecked to continue for so long. Regardless of whether the proponent for the Comfort Women that are seeking justice can put out a number that is accurate or not, the fact that remains that the Japanese government remains legally, categorically responsible for this crime against humanity that was committed, and internationally, legally, it's been spelled out what the corrective measures are to ensure that it never happens again. And Abe stands right smack in the middle of that promise that we're pushing, because his entire agenda that motivated him to deny not only the Comfort Women system, but other atrocities that the Japanese Empire committed during World War II stands against the re-glorification of Japan and the revival of the Japanese Empire that draws its mandate of the superior position through the state Shintoism that puts the emperor, you know, as the most supreme being. It's very, very important to note that this whole agenda for Japanese nation building depended on creating a solid argument that the Japanese stood to expand and govern those other nations and territories, precisely based on their special lineage from the emperor. And Abe, and starting from his grandfather, you know, who was a former Prime Minister Kishi, was a firm believer in the glory of the Japanese Empire. And unfortunately, the Japanese Empire cannot exist without racialized colonial structure of nation building. And that's what puts all the remaining girls and women in the present as well as the future at risk of being afflicted with another case of violence, whether it's one person or a million, you know, of them. Because a world that cannot bring justice to the Comfort Women of, you know, 70, 80 years ago will not be able to prevent the recurrence of people that are, you know, with Abe. It's not just Abe who are behind his agenda, although Abe is gone now, you know, from pushing on this agenda.
What would you say is Shinzo Abe's legacy after his sort of surprising assassination this past summer?
Well, under Abe's administration, we already talked about one of his top agenda is to kill Japan's World War II history. And you raised Japan's public school textbooks, any mention of Rape of Nanjing, chemical and biological experimentation under the Unit 731 against allies and POWs and civilians, slave labor, Japanese military sexual slavery system, etc. And the result is a whole generation of post-World War II Japanese citizens knowing nothing about what happened during World War II. And contrasting that to Germany, which criminalizes words or actions of individuals that deny the Holocaust. He also made an oral agreement, a 2015 agreement with South Korea, allegedly setting the Comfort Women issue at rest, but only to repeat his denial that Comfort Women institution existed shortly after the agreement was made. And that is why today the Comfort Women movement rejects the 2015 agreement as one that would exonerate Japan from an honest apology and alleviate Japan from complying with the United Nations standards of apology made after crimes against humanity have been committed. As to his lineage to Kishi, it is pretty horrific also, not to mention that Kishi was the mastermind of the slave labor system in Manchuria, and there was not one single operation undertaken during World War II in China that he did not know about. He was classified as a Class A criminal by the International Tribunal post after World War II. And unfortunately, he was resurrected by the United States because he was seen as a very good manager, and he would be seen as someone who could restore Japan, who has totally broken up during post-World War. They were impoverished, having expended all the money on the military, and he would be one to put Japan back together and be made a United States puppet. Well, he did good for America and continued to do America's bidding even to today. But there's also a linkage between Kishi to the Moonies, which is the Unification Church that very few people know about, because Abe's grandfather, who, Kishi, as we mentioned, who was became Japan's prime minister from 1957 to 1960, had a very friendly relationship with the Moonies. And he was the one who established an outpost for the Moonies in Tokyo, which gave the Moonies a very successful entree into the Japanese conservative segment of the LPD. And today, about 400 members of the LPD belong or have some affiliation with the Unification Church. And what holds them together is their extreme right-wing view towards women, very anti-gay, and also their very anti-communist policies. And using that, the politics and social values, as they call them, together, they were able to attract a lot of people into their membership. Unfortunately, they employ very extreme measures and coercive tactics towards their members, extracting their money, reducing many of them into bankruptcy and family divisions. And that was one of the issues that surfaced as a result of the assassination of Shinzo Abe, that the alleged assailant talked about how his mother gave up all the money, close to about $700,000 U.S., to the Unification Church and creating a severe problem for the family. And there are other families in Japan that also have suffered likewise. And this has created such an embarrassing scenario for the current Kishida government that they are now caught in a real bind. They have lost Japanese support of the state funeral. Even I heard that Shinzo Abe's widow is not in support of that. And there's a lot of question about the budget that's being used for this funeral. We're talking about $12 million U.S. Majority of that is to accommodate foreign dignitaries. And the reasons that Kishida gave for this expensive funeral is that, number one, that Abe was one of the longest-serving prime ministers. So who cares, you know, longest-serving? But what did he do, okay? Secondly, is that because there's such an outpouring of compassion and support and sympathy from the allies, so he felt that he needed to respond to them with courtesy and invite them to a state funeral. Well, now it is upended, and he finds himself in a quandary, an embarrassment, and for the Japanese leaders, losing face is a very embarrassing thing, and he is no question in my mind losing face everywhere, both domestically and internationally, for such a disaster fiasco.
That was Julie Tang and Miho Kim speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about the still raw issue of Japanese comfort women during World War II and the militarization of Asia. A protest of Abe's state funeral is scheduled for Monday, September 26th at noon to be held at the Japanese consulate on Battery Street in San Francisco. For more information on the comfort women issue, go to remembercomfortwomen.org.
Standing for freedom, freedom till he comes, 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 standing for freedom, freedom
till
for freedom, freedom till he comes, standing 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 for freedom, freedom till he comes.
This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Next, we'll consider President Biden's invocation of the National Emergencies Act of 1976 to control the Horn of Africa. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has this story.
You're broken down and tired.
For the whole year, the narrative was a false narrative. It was all about TPLF. The people that were committing the crime were being seen as victims, and the victims that were being killed, massacred, like these names that you're holding from my cadre, were being seen as the aggressors.
We in the Black Alliance for Peace stand in uncompromising opposition to the U.S.-led imperialist aggression against Ethiopia, and by extension against the neighboring countries, Eritrea, Somalia, and beyond.
The U.S. military is not welcome in Africa.
U.S. policy has actually been very consistent for the last 40 years when it comes to the Horn of Africa. Keep them divided.
Ethiopia! Ethiopia! Ethiopia!
Those are highlights of a November 2021 rally held by Horn of Africa activists outside the White House to protest U.S. meddling in Ethiopia and the rest of the Horn. On Sunday, September 18, they returned to protest again, 1 week after President Biden renewed Executive Order 14046 for another year. The order declares that the two-year civil war in northern Ethiopia, quote, continues to pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, unquote. Earlier this week, in a Twitter space organized by Ethiopian-American journalist and activist Tarmila Aragawi, American journalist and activist Eugene Puryear explained that this executive authority was based on the National Emergencies Act of 1976.
One thing I just want to say is that, you know, this is an authorization in the National Emergencies Act. And just to give people some context who may not know what that is, it's not very well known. This is actually an act that's used on a regular basis around sanctions. Like, for instance, people have probably heard about how the U.S. seized the assets of the Afghan government held in the Federal Reserve. They use this act to do it. So basically what it is, it dates to 1976, but it gives the president the authority by invoking a national emergency to essentially avoid a range of different pieces. Sometimes it's congressional oversight, sometimes it's regulatory, but it just sort of helps them, you know, move. So it really is often used with sanctions type legislation or to set the stage for sanctions in order to make sure there's no gumming up of the works or pushback or bureaucratic whatever, so they can just, you know, attack it. But I think that what's important here is that many of these things are not, in fact, national emergencies. And oftentimes it's very unclear what their relationship is to the, you know, as this stated, the national security and diplomacy of the United States. I mean, how exactly this is sort of in a direct sense, like when we think about national security, I think a lot of people think about recently passed 9/11 or something like that. So how is there an emergency? I mean, obviously there's an emergency in the context of what's happening in the Horn, but how is that an emergency that allows the president of the United States to essentially abrogate a huge amount of the statutory roadblocks that are put up to prevent the president from just doing whatever they want in order to facilitate sanctions? I mean, I think that's a really interesting question to ask. I think it has a clear answer, but I think it's an important question to ask because a lot of these things, you just don't think about them. The president takes actions and it seems like whatever, the president is doing what he's doing, it's within his powers or whatever. But I think all these very specific things about how they do it is important in terms of the framing of what they're actually trying to do. And I think that in the context of what this executive order is saying and what it's really doing and allowing, which is for the president to act to level sanctions on anyone, anywhere in the world that is deemed to be, you know, acting in a way the U.S. feels is detrimental to Ethiopia. So it's extraordinarily subjective, but extraordinarily broad-based. And I think that's also very notable that they're giving themselves the wide authority, the Biden administration, to take very broad action against almost anyone on the planet Earth vis-a-vis the conflict in northern Ethiopia. So a major internationalization of the conflict and a major statement about America's willingness to use its powers extraterritorially to punish people for doing things it doesn't like. And I think that's what it really comes down to. I mean, why is this a national emergency vis-a-vis the national security and the diplomacy of the United States? Sort of an interesting phrase, really, the way it's even phrased. But I think it does get to the heart of the conflict, quite frankly, that for the point of view of the U.S. government, the conflict that's happening in the Horn of Africa and northern Ethiopia specifically is 100% dangerous to their plans for the Horn of Africa more broadly. And certainly, I think in the context of what's happening here, and when I say that, I don't mean the TPLF. I mean, the potentiality of the TPLF being defeated is a major problem. And they want to give themselves as many tools as they possibly can to shape the environment, to shape the policy, and whatever it may be. And I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more as we go deeper into the space. But I think it's important to note that the way the U.S. actually views this conflict is as one of, you know, the most core issues vis-a-vis their foreign policy in Africa and elsewhere. I mean, they use this act a lot on sanctions, but when you look at the other things they're using them on, it tends to be big geopolitical issues. So that means that the U.S. is putting the geopolitics of the Horn of Africa at a very high level in terms of the level of seriousness, and the level of importance, and their willingness to use the full extent of the presidential powers in order to put their thumb on the scale in terms of determining what the outcome may be. And I think that that is an important statement about, you know, how, in my view, I guess you could say, how in many ways malicious U.S. foreign policy is, but we'll get into that a little bit later. But I think specifically to the question that's being asked, you know, what is this act and why is it being invoked? I think it's really being invoked to give the United States the biggest possible stick with the widest range of options in order to make sure they have the ability to put their thumb on the scale and shape the politics of Ethiopia and shape the politics of the Horn of Africa more broadly. So I think it's a shot across the bow. I think it speaks to the importance of the issue in a major way. And I think it speaks to the fact that the United States views everything happening in the Horn right now as absolutely critical to its own geostrategic goals in what obviously is, I think, one of the most geopolitically important regions of the country.
That was activist journalist Eugene Puryear on President Joe Biden's continuation of Executive Order 14046.
Western media, you've been spreading lies, just to sow confusion, just to destabilize. My sovereign editor, divide and conquer, your quest to take over, my sweet home Africa. Mass migration has started, millions have departed. All the minerals you stole, you discounted millions of souls. Sanctions are wasteless sanctions, you'd love to see us kneel. But with the can-do people, we will never yield. And I say no more, no more, no more. And we say no more.
There is growing concern about the expanding war in Ukraine. In Moldova, a nation of 2.5 million people just south of Ukraine, more than 10,000 people rallied in the capital to protest skyrocketing inflation and the government's failure to respond. The cost of gas and electricity has gone up over 300%, and winter is coming. In San Francisco, a rally was held at the offices of California U.S. Senator Alex Padilla, opposing any further funding for the war in Ukraine and the wars around the world. Bert Knorr of the International Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America spoke at the rally.
No more war! No more war! One, two, three, four! One, two, three, four! One, two, three, four. Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming out here today. And if people don't know, there's a senator, one of our senators, one of the two senators from this state that has an office in this building. His name is Alex Padilla. The reason we're out here is because we're against this war that's going on. And I want to say, the war is a disaster, as has been pointed out. It's a disaster for the people of Ukraine. It's a disaster for the people of Russia. It's a disaster for the people in the global south that are being devastated by the food shortage and the energy shortage, and famine is on the march throughout the global south, the Middle East and Africa, and so on. It's a danger to the people of the world because we are at the most dangerous point since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Let me say, 60 years ago, next month, we were on the brink of nuclear war, and we narrowly escaped. And today we are once again on the brink of nuclear war.
Yes, yes.
And that's the stakes of it. And not only that, we're on the brink, we're at the beginning of the climate disaster that threatens the whole human race, human civilization, and every other species on this planet. And that is being accelerated by this war.
Yes.
It's being accelerated by the fossil fuel companies that are making billions off this war. It's being accelerated by the weapons makers who are making billions off of this war. So the war is a disaster.
Yes.
And it needs to stop, okay? Now, we've been fed a lot of lies about this war. We've been fed a steady diet of lies. And I got a few of them. I sent a letter to Alex Padilla about my concerns about this war and that it could lead to a nuclear war. It was part of an initiative by World Beyond War that said no to World War III. And I want to tell you what some of his response was. Here it is. Dear Mr. Knorr, thank you for writing to share your concerns regarding Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. I appreciate hearing from you. I stand with the people of Ukraine in the face of Russia's unprovoked invasion of their country. Now, lie number one, this war, whatever you think of Russia, the Russian invasion definitely, brought the conflict to a whole new level, okay? But it was not unprovoked. It was not unprovoked. Like if you have a gang that's surrounding your house, okay, and you try to defend yourself, that's not an unprovoked action. That's one lie, okay? Number two, we're told that this is a war that the U.S. is fighting for democracy, all right? And we're told that we need to stop Russia. People may remember the domino theory. Back in the Vietnam War, during the Vietnam War, there was a domino theory that if Vietnam fell, then the whole world would fall. Okay, all of Southeast Asia would fall. So we have another domino theory. We're supposed to believe that Russia, which can't take Ukraine, its neighboring country, is going to sweep across Europe and conquer all of Europe. That is the premise that we're dealing with. And let me say another thing. We see over and over again on the news how this is Putin's war. It's Putin's war. Well, let me say something. The U.S. is a party to this war. This is a proxy war. What does it mean when you're a proxy war? What it means is you're fighting your adversary, but you're using other people to fight and die. We met with Barbara Lee's staff a couple of days ago. We had a Zoom call with them. They said that this was a colonial war that the U.S. needed to oppose. Okay, number one, do people believe that the U.S. is a force against colonialism? In a world where the U.S. has 800 bases all around the world, over 100 countries, has invaded countries from Vietnam to Iraq to Afghanistan, on and on and on, 100 interventions since the end of the Cold War, the U.S. is not a force against colonialism. If anything, the U.S. is trying to colonize Ukraine. Ukraine is being, agricultural sector is being opened up to private corporations. Ukraine is being made a forward base for the U.S. And Zelensky talks about he wants to be like Israel. He wants to be like Israel. He wants to be the Israel of Eastern Europe. What does that mean? That means that he wants to be the military state that will carry out the wishes of the American Empire. So when they say this is a Putin's war, let me say something. To my mind, this is as much Biden's war as it is Putin's war. And why is that? Why is that? Because, number one, the U.S. was meddling in Ukraine for years before the war started. Number two, the U.S. has done a military buildup in Ukraine. And by the way, that has been accelerated since Biden was president. Okay? Obama, for better or for worse, never gave lethal aid to Ukraine. Biden has been pouring billions of dollars in weapons into Ukraine. And one other thing, it seems that, I was going to read you a list of Democrats that had voted against weapons for the war. Okay, I'm at the end of the list. There is no list. There's not a single member of the Democratic Party that has voted against billions of dollars for the war in Ukraine. Not one. Not one. In addition to the $50 billion plus dollars that have already been allocated for the war, there's a bill that Biden is submitting for another $13.7 billion. By the time Congress is done with that, that'll be $20 billion. So we're talking about probably $100 billion a year or more going to the war. In a country where we cannot afford to house our people, we cannot afford to provide health care, we cannot afford to educate our young, we cannot afford to deal with climate, that for some reason we can afford hundreds of billions of dollars for a war that we have no business being involved in. That we have no business being involved in. I want to say, back in the day there was a song called "We're the Cops of the World." I don't know if you remember it. It was a Phil Oakes song. You probably need to be an old folky from the old days to remember this song. But the U.S. thinks that it's the cops of the world. Let me tell you something. We cannot afford, the working people and poor people in this country cannot afford to be the cops of the world. We have no interest in being the cops of the world. We're interested in peace. We're interested in diplomacy. We're interested in the collaboration among nations to deal with the problems that face us and not the preservation of the U.S. domination of the world. That's what Lockheed wants. That's what the national security state wants. But it's not in our interest. Another lie from Alex Padilla's letter. He said the reason he was supporting all this money for the war is because it was in our national security interest. Our national security interest. Do you feel safer because of the war in Ukraine? Absolutely. I mean, honestly.
That was Bert Knorr of the Democratic Socialists of America's International Committee speaking at a rally against the Ukraine war outside California Senator Alex Padilla's San Francisco office.
Come get out of the way, boys. Quick, get out of the way. You'd better watch what you say, boys. Better watch what you say. We've rammed in your harbor and tied to your port, and our pistols are hungry and our tempers are short. So bring your daughters around to the fore, 'cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
Ukraine's Western-backed leader Volodymyr Zelensky opened Wall Street's New York Stock Exchange on a video link on September 6th and announced his country is open for foreign corporations to exploit it. Economist Michael Hudson and Multipolarista host Ben Norton discuss the neoliberal capitalist shock therapy measures being imposed on the war-torn nation.
A friend of mine, a Canadian activist and writer, Jake Calio, and I wrote an article over at multipolarista.com, and it's titled West Prepares to Plunder Post-War Ukraine with Neoliberal Shock Therapy, Privatization, Deregulation, Slashing Worker Protections. This is a conference that was held this July in Switzerland called the Ukraine Recovery Conference, in which a bunch of Western governments and corporate leaders met together to plan neoliberal shock therapy to impose on Ukraine. And we couldn't have seen a more blatant symbol of this than the fact that Ukraine's Western-backed leader, Zelensky, on September 6th, he opened the bell digitally, at least via Zoom in the morning, at the New York Stock Exchange. And I mean, it's really incredible. Hashtag Advantage Ukraine, the slogan, we are free, we are strong, we are open for business. And if you read what the financial press is saying about this, this is from this website, Business Wire. President Zelensky rings bell at New York Stock Exchange to signify Ukraine is open for business. And it notes this is a $400 billion in investment options. It spans public-private partnerships, privatization, and private ventures. A USAID-supported project team of investment bankers appointed by Ukraine's Ministry of Economy will work with businesses interested in investing. They quote the president of the New York Stock Exchange Group, who said, "We stand for freedom, investor protection, and unfettered access to capital. We are pleased to welcome President Zelensky virtually to the New York Stock Exchange Bell Podium, a symbol of freedom and opportunity our U.S. capital markets have enabled around the globe." This, to me, it says everything. It points out that Ukraine has been working with the G7 and the EU to reform the country's tax system, that is, cut taxes on corporations and the rich, to create a new legal framework, and to adopt new rules and legislations to allow companies to build a transparent corporate structure, attract foreign investment more easily, and use additional mechanisms to protect intangible assets. So honestly, what they're announcing is a massive corporate giveaway. What do you think about this policy of Ukraine being open for business?
Well, it certainly didn't say everything. After Labor Day, significantly, Tuesday on September 6th, the day that Zelensky rang the bell at the stock exchange, he had an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that did say everything. He said, "What we've done is abolish the right of labor to join labor unions. We have abolished the right of collective bargaining. Every wage agreement is going to be an individual choice between the worker and the employer. That's a fair market. We're abolishing all of labor's rights that are in the Constitution. We are rejecting the European Union labor laws. We are rejecting everything that the UN International Labor Organization said. We have reduced labor under the new law that I have just passed to absolute abject dependency. So if you work in Ukraine, not only are we going to give you whatever you can buy from the kleptocrats, giving them an appropriate markup and owning it, but you will have a completely docile labor force such as no country has seen since the era of Pinochet. And you've got to read the Wall Street Journal editorial. It's jaw-dropping. It is absolutely, it's like a parody of what a socialist would have written about how the class war would be put into action by a fascist government. This is literally what fascism is. So, of course, he was welcomed on the stock exchange for abolishing labor's rights. You could not have a more black and white example from than what you just pointed out.
Yeah, and it's really sad considering that Ukraine already is the poorest country in Europe. And it's one of the most corrupt countries in Europe, even according to these metrics of like Western government-backed organizations. So we've seen that after the overthrow of the Soviet Union in 1991, that in Russia in particular, there was this brutal neoliberal shock therapy. Gorbachev just died. He helped bring this in. Gorbachev did this famous Pizza Hut commercial, basically showing that he sold out his country for Pizza Hut. And we saw that under Yeltsin, this alcoholic U.S. puppet in Russia, the life expectancy of Russians decreased by several years. According to UNICEF, millions of Russians died in excess deaths because of the neoliberal shock therapy imposed on Russia. And of course, Ukraine suffered, but the neoliberal shock therapy imposed on Ukraine wasn't as severe as it was on Russia. And there still are some state-owned assets in Ukraine that all of these Western corporations are just frothing at the bit. They're salivating about trying to get their hooks into and to privatize all of these assets. So this is a country that is already the poorest in Europe. It's already one of the most corrupt countries on earth. It has a massive problem with far-right extremism. And now it's being flooded with $40 billion of weapons just from the US, billions of dollars more weapons from Europe. I mean, this seems like such a massive powder keg. I can't even imagine how disastrous it'll be. Considering the effect of the neoliberal shock therapy imposed on Chile, you mentioned under Pinochet, the neoliberal shock therapy imposed on Russia and the disastrous consequences. I mean, what do you think this is going to do, not only to Ukraine, but to Europe?
Well, this is exactly what Mr. Macron said when he said the end of affluence. The Ukrainian labor force has just experienced the end of affluence in neoliberal style. And as Mr. Zelensky said, it may be the end of affluence for the labor force, but it's going to be a bonanza for you investors in the New York Stock Exchange. Come on in, join the party. Somebody's loss has turned into somebody else's gain. And that's what happens in a class war that's a zero-sum game. There's no attempt at all to raise living standards. And the problem, you said Ukraine is the poorest country in Europe, but Zelensky said it's not poor enough. He said, you think this is something? Wait till our new law takes effect. That'll really show you what it means to be the poorest country in Europe. But it'll also be the richest country in Europe for the 1%, because as you just pointed out, the kleptocrat class there was the most corrupt. I've met some of them, and it's an experience.
That was economist Michael Hudson in conversation with Ben Norton, publisher of Multipolarista. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Steve Zeltzer, with assistance from Ann Garrison, and engineered by Polina Vasilyev. The executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasilyev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.